Hey folks, welcome to the show. Sharad, Twitter is now X. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I saw that. You know, it's a change already, no, right? Have you heard about the story of X though? Like, it's a long fascination that Musk had with X. He wanted to rename PayPal as X PayPal also back in the day, things like that.
I think one of his earlier companies, and I think his kid's name also is an X. So there's definitely something going around there. Last week, we had a super interesting chat around a debt relief platform. So obviously there we were looking at things from a borrower standpoint. But today we are looking at, again, fixed income as an asset class, but more from a investment perspective. Yeah. Gives me great pleasure to welcome Saurav Ghosh, co-founder at Giraffe. Giraffe with a J. Hey, Saurav, how's it going, man?
Going well, Nikhil and Sharad. Good to meet you guys and be on this show.
Obviously, Giraffe is super fascinating. You guys are democratizing alternate asset classes, namely fixed income, which is something which is doesn't have the kind of depth within the retail ecosystem. And I guess that's where your platform comes. It would be great to get an initial sense of what exactly the offering here is. And say, if I'm a Giraffe customer, what kind of a ride am I in for?
Yeah, so Nikhil, our offering is very, very simple. What we do is we offer access to what we call as fixed income opportunities to individual investors. The way we define fixed income, at least on our platform, Giraffe, is anything that gives you a fixed return over a fixed period of time. Right? That's how we define fixed income. We believe as Giraffe that fixed income is a very powerful asset class for short to medium term investments. If I have a 5-year, 10-year view of my money, I would rather myself invest that money in equities, because equity markets is very stable over the long run. But obviously, there's a lot of volatility when it comes to short-term to medium-term investments in equity markets. And hence, fixed income, that's where the asset class comes in, is really, really powerful for short to medium-term investments. So what we do on Giraffe is we offer fixed income opportunities which are less than 3 years in tenure, right? Okay. And there's a lot of diversity in our offering. So we offer products right from 30 days in tenure going up to 3 years. The idea is to enable individual investors create a fixed income portfolio. And creating a portfolio, means that you need to have a lot of diversity. So 30 days to 3 years in tenure, we offer yields between 6% going all the way up to 18-19%.
Right.
And anything in this band is what a Giraffe offering is all about. Right. And as I mentioned, all of our products will have a common theme, that it will offer fixed returns over a fixed period of time. Right. So we keep that simple. So you might earn 12% in 1 year, 14% in 2 years, let's say 10% in 90 days, right? So whatever it is, but you will know when you make your investment that I will get this much percentage of return in this time horizon. So there is a lot of predictability and certainty to the future cash flows of your investment.
When it comes to fixed income or credit in general, it's the less sexy part, right? At least from a retail lens. I mean, it's probably more cerebral and more technical, but it's the less sexy part. And if I think of as a retail investor, the first things that come to my mind are, things like some government securities, corporate bonds, fixed deposits, and pretty much that, right? What is the challenge?
Maybe even debt mutual funds.
Debt mutual funds, yes. What is the challenge you saw as a retail investor? Effectively, these products are out there, right? But what were the gaps in the journey which you thought something like Giraffe could fix?
So I think, we basically saw three critical challenges, right? And two of them Giraffe will fix, and I'll talk about the third one as well. The first challenge was actually to create products, which are inherently attractive for individual investors. If you see the landscape of fixed income products, all the ones that you mentioned, whether it's fixed deposits, public provident funds, debt mutual funds, corporate bonds and papers, which are publicly available, all of these have a common, I would say, theme again, which is they offer very low yields, right? Barely inflation beating returns in the country.
Right.
And typically, if you now go into corporate bonds, which is the larger fixed income category across the globe, In India, the most publicly available corporate bonds will give you 6, 7, 8% return, but you'll also have to invest over 5-year, 10-year, 15-year period, right? Mm-hmm. Now that's barely beating inflation. So fundamentally for me as an individual investor, that product itself is not attractive. Mm-hmm. So the first problem statement for us to solve was that how do we actually bring fundamentally attractive opportunities for individual investors, where then for them it can be a meaningful part of their overall financial portfolio, right? So that was point one. The second thing is that, you know, now that, you know, we are in the fixed income category, right now, all the traditional products are catering only to the lowest end of the risk spectrum, right? Which is your, as I mentioned, 5, 6, 7%. So it's either you're parking a fixed deposit with a bank or you're doing like AAA rated papers. So it's the lowest end of the risk spectrum. So our idea was that can we widen this spectrum, where we leave the choice to individual investors, where with an additional delta risk, you can earn a delta return, right? And then all individual investors are, I would say, free to invest basis their risk appetite, basis their financial goals that they want to meet. And if we can do that, probably investors can also earn maybe a double-digit return, 10, 11, 12% through a fixed income product, which is then very close to, I would say, at least on a pre-tax basis, what equity as an instrument or mutual funds, equity mutual fund will give you over the long period of time.
Got it. So you're pushing the risk envelope a bit and effectively, but are you like a market maker or a distributor of sorts of those products? Like they are out there, companies are issuing securities of a certain nature, of a shorter tenure and a higher kind of IRR return? Or are you also involved in actually being like an originator of sorts, like actually sitting down with issuers, structuring these products and then having some sort of an exclusive right to distribute them through your platform? Because I mean, when I think of Giraffe and when you kind of mentioned all these things, you know, I also think of companies like say a Grip Invest or a Bonds Card or India Bonds, where you do get, maybe not in India Bonds and Bonds Card, that's probably more listed in larger companies, but in Grip Invest, you'll definitely find, you know, shorter tenure products, which are probably pushing like 12, 13, 14% in IRR terms.
Yeah, so, you know, we do that. So, and again, why do we actually focus on origination? So, you know, when we bring opportunities on our platform, every opportunity is unique to us. That means we have met these companies. We've, you know.
So, you have an exclusive arrangement with them.
Yeah, we're all exclusive. So, you know, we meet these companies. We do the structuring. We do the credit assessment. We'll do their due diligences. We have an internal investment committee which finally approves transactions that get live on our platform, right? So it's I would say a lot of rigorous assessment and diligence time that we take and effort that we put in to ensure that we are, opening up opportunities which are friendly for retail investors, even from a risk perspective. Right. Finally, we are a platform where individual investors are participating, right? So what is the right kind of risk that, you know, we can expose them to is very critical to our decision making. And we spend a lot of time, on that aspect while, thinking about doing any transaction, as Giraffes, right? So that's a very cornerstone of our...
When you talk about origination, right, when you talk about 30 days and so on, one of the biggest things that we see that comes up is probably working capital financing, right? It seems like a pain point for so many businesses in the country. Is that sort of... key piece of overall borrowers who are sort of trying to fund working capital and are looking to sort of raise short-term debt, and hence it's sort of there's a match between what your investors want as well.
So the reason we, you know, working capital is one of the key products that we have. So we have two key products. One is, I would say, corporate debt, where we take balance sheet position with companies. And then the second is, you know, supply chain financing, which is like working capital financing for companies, right? These are the two key products. About each of them are like 40% of our overall, I would say, exposure as Giraffe. And balance, we do multiple other products, which put together is about 20%, right? So working capital, as you can see, is a key part of our overall portfolio. The reason we do working capital finance is too, on the investor side, is actually it's unique as a sense because, company needs money for 30, 60, 90 days, right? Yeah. And because you're solving that need, that means as an investor, you're able to invest in a use case for 30, 60, 90 days. So in that sense, it works well for the company and for individual investors. It, you know, I think it's a great product to invest your liquid funds or, funds which are just lying in your bank account and you really don't have a use case, right? So it works very well for both sides. The second is, genuinely, we are solving a very big credit need in the country, right? The MSME, SME ecosystem is a large market to tap into. So obviously, there is a lot of potential to actually grow and solve that as an alternate capital provider, in the credit ecosystem. So it works well for both, and hence it's a key focus.
And most of this sort of investments, like, I guess they are sort of unsecured. Like, I mean, maybe there's some invoice-backed funding as well, but I suspect most of them are sort of basically unsecured and cash-based underwriting.
Yeah, absolutely. So all supply chain financing products, I would say 95% of them. So they are definitely unsecured in the sense that they are cash flow backed, but there is no hard collateral. In some cases, we do take personal guarantees and corporate guarantees, etc. But again, these are softer collateral, and they'll not be any hard collateral associated with it.
Interesting, like you mentioned that, in the origination part, obviously when you're originating, there is some level of, softer, hard underwriting exercise that you yourself are doing, right? And one is obviously to look at it more like as a boutique setup. You do a soft underwriting, but then, you kind of syndicate the transaction. And the other is that you're actually providing some financing on the table as well. Do you also like buy these bonds, warehouse it on your books, and then, sell it in the secondary market? Do you do that? Like, do you take balance sheet risk yourself? Or is it more of, a marketplace or a matching principle which applies here?
Right. No, so here we do the underwriting, right? So that means, the way we work is when we go and tell a company that, here is our term sheet for, let's say, 10 crores, right?
Yeah.
That means that it is also Jira's commitment to ensure that the company is getting that 10 crore on the committed date, right? Yeah. So for whatever reason, let's say we are not able to find a demand through Jira as a platform, still we need to uphold that commitment, because that's how we build our trust and brand even in the corporate ecosystem, right? Yes. If I commit and then shy away, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
Right. So we actually take balance sheet risk in that sense. So we actually commit capital upfront from our balance sheet, and then whether we are able to find demand through Jira as a platform is our headache. It's not the company's headache. And hence that's why, so yes, we do take that risk. What we don't do is finally, we even downsell 100% of our exposure. So we don't keep any residual portion as our skin in the game. That is at the moment. Going forward, because we are early in our capital journey as well, when, as a startup, we'll have a little bit more balance sheet strength, we will be able to, participate through our own skin in the game, till maturity, right? So that's the idea.
Right.
How difficult is it to sort of do? It's pretty interesting, right? And how... One of the issues that often people have is these are sort of smallish companies, unrated. How difficult is it to sort of actually do the due diligence and even assess corporate governance, right? Sort of actually figure that out, and authenticity of numbers. And it's not an easy process, right, when you're doing it at scale. So is there some tech involved in there, or is it sort of just your ability to actually identify companies which have real cash flow problems, and that's about it?
No, it's a bit of both. I think if you are a capital provider in the country, and if you put a front page ad in the newspaper that I'm here to provide capital, you will have a 10-kilometer line outside of your office, right? So I don't think anyone can identify, I would say, that who is a good counterparty in that sense. It's more about the diligence as well, right? So it has both aspects, which is tech and then obviously our experience, right? And what everything that we do. So a part of the tech is basically there is a lot of data which is there in the public ecosystem. Obviously, the need is to actually tap into all of those, data points, and then create your own intel in some sense, right? So, and for here, we use a lot of tech integration. So just reading, for example, what is out there in the media, let's say was there in, through your Googles, right? So that is one part of it. The second is registrar of companies, ROC. There's a lot of filing that all companies do on an annual basis. So there's a lot of data that you get from their balance sheet, annual statements to charges, which is effectively encumbrance or charge. Technically, when you take a debt or any kind of liability, you'll file that with the ROC. The third is all your legal databases, right? All your high courts, your courts, they also make, filings which are digital today. So there is a lot of, I would say, publicly, and there are, few more, right? So there are a lot of today, your bureau scores, right? Your city bills, etc., right? So those are also standard. So there are about at least something, there are a lot of publicly available data. What we do is we use a lot of tech to read all of this data. accumulate it, collate it, so that it comes in our format the way we like to, I would say, interpret the data, and that's how the output is thrown, right? So in that sense, at least the basic easy stuff is very quick, and we don't need to, I would spend a lot of time in doing that. The
Sort of just one thing, like a lot of this data, right, is digital in nature, but it's probably scanned photographs of pilings, right? Is it hard to sort of digest the data using only tech? So how do you sort of, because I don't know if there's a PD, scanners are available which can interpret, but I don't know if that technology.
No, we don't do that actually. Yeah. So this is one part of it, right? So here, there will be someone from our credit and risk team who actually goes through each of this collated data point, right? It helps to do is, someone doesn't need to go to these six places, actually key in, find out whether it's available or not available. So the collation part is really smooth and simple. It comes as a single docket. There is a manual intervention today required to kind of read it. We are obviously trying to build and, I would say, use better technology to kind of do that more seamlessly. Yeah. The second bit is, then when we take a lot of data from the company that we work with, so they'll share us their bank account statements, all of their documents, their MISs. We kind of then match what we get from public systems to whatever the MIS is, that they share us. So we know broadly, how the numbers are looking. The second thing is, for example, once they send us all of their bank statements, we actually digitize the cash. So we actually map cash flows on a month-on-month basis. So if you, for example, give me 5 bank account statements for the last financial year, we will draw out your cash flows, which is inflows and credits and debits, and then kind of see whether it overlays with your MIS, whether it overlays with your financial statement. So that's one part of it, right? So this is all that comes, I would say, more from our understanding and experience. And then the third part and the most important critical pillar for us is reference checks, right? So we do reference checks from, we will definitely go meet the founder. We will definitely go meet, we will do a site inspection at their warehouse or their stores, depending on the nature of the business. We will talk to people down the line, at the shop floor, at the warehouse, and, we get a sense of that. Once we meet the founder, we get a sense of, obviously, his personality, his thought process, which becomes very critical. And then, most of the company that we work with, they are already banking with some financial institution, whether it's a bank or NBFC. So we will definitely go and talk to that specific RM who handles the account. We will go and take a reference check from there, some vendor, contractor who works with them. And obviously, if it's like in the new age economy, then we'll definitely talk to their equity investor, which might be a VC, PE fund, etc. Right? But all of this 100% needs to happen for us to build comfort on corporate governance, on a lot of things, right? Also, you get to understand a lot of corporate governance on soft aspects like who the auditor is. Also, the way they account few of the entries. Right, like a typical thing in the tech ecosystem, you notice is to capitalize tech costs. It is done to show better EBITDA, lower losses, etc. Right, but that's, I would say, is again just then you're trying to, I would say, downplay what the actual this thing, right? So a lot of these thought processes become clear from a more nuanced data points, and which is where what we focus on. That's why I said it's a lot to do with obviously data available, technology, and our own experience and process.
Yeah. Sort of like this. Segment is fairly untapped, right? And that's why it's attractive also. But on the other end, when it comes to Indian debt markets, probably that point is not just valid to this segment, it's valid to most of the ecosystem. As an investor, am I expected to like hold these instrumental maturity, or is there some sort of a liquidity event I can get? Is there like a marketplace angle there which is worth pursuing? Because you guys are anyways doing exclusive deals here, right? Yeah. How do you kind of view that, and how do you think it's changing?
So yeah, it's a very interesting question. So I think what we would love to solve for is today we see it's a chicken and egg problem, right? So without participation in fixed income, with limited participation, the secondary market.
Primary has to be there, then only that will come.
Primary has to be big, then there can be a secondary market, right? Yeah. And the even in the public bond markets, right, where the AAA, AA rated issuance is happening, even though volumes are big, you will see there is no liquidity. Why? Because 90% of the subscribers are your insurance agencies, pension funds, large banks who are holding everything to maturity. So they are not sellers. And if there are no sellers, there is no secondary market, right? Yeah. So that's the challenge with us. So now our first step is to create, I would say, enough participation in primary. Then, you know, I think the liquidity and the secondary markets will evolve, right? So today, that is a key reason why we focus on short to medium term investments, because we know there is no liquidity as an option. Right. So we know that you don't want to lock in your money for 5 years. So we might as well give you options which are, you know, shorter in 10 or 1 year, 2 years. So you can keep rotating and reinvesting if required. At least you're not locked in. Right. So that's one part of it. The second is from a liquidity perspective, as you mentioned, you know, yes, there is a possibility to create a market, but there are also a lot of, you know, I would say we need to find the right structure to do that, because one is the regulatory part, right? Today, SEBI or other regulators can view you as a stock exchange if you start, you know, doing market making in private markets as well, right? So one is that aspect. For that, we engage with regulators to see obviously what are the best path to getting that done. The second is also capital, right? Am I the one who's providing liquidity, or am I only market making, right? If I am the one providing liquidity, my ALM and my, you know, assets and liabilities need to then be taken into account. So there are multiple perspectives to this. But I think the first step and the first problem for us to solve is to create the primary market. Once that is operating at scale, I think, you know, then there's a genuine need to actually then solve for the secondary market, which we will do. And we have a lot of thoughts over there, but I think it's just a more step-by-step approach.
Right. What is the average ticket size on both sides from an investor standpoint and from a loan disbursement standpoint?
Typically? So from a loan disbursement standpoint, we typically like to work with companies where we are giving sanctions anywhere between, I would say, 25 to 50 odd crores. Okay. And the idea is to, we don't do that in a single tranche. We try to disburse that over maybe 2-3 tranches. So, you know, we build up to that export. The second bit is on the investor side. Our minimum investment on a platform is 1 lakh rupees. The reason is that we felt, you know, our products are still, I would say, exotic. You know, they are not well understood by the larger market out there. So we want to first invest our time and energy and also a lot of education and awareness. Until then, these products are not suitable for first-time investors or, you know, people who are not that financially aware. Hence, our minimum ticket size is 1 lakh. Typically, we see that people take about a 10 lakh rupee exposure with Giraffe over a period of time. That period of time can be 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, but that's typically that's our average, I would say, exposure for a customer on our platform.
Right. Yeah, and let's say a user is putting 1 lakh on the platform. Is that mapped entirely to one deal or one sort of loan, or is that sort of also broken down across the portfolio multiple? I mean, there are two kinds of portfolio risk that you can manage, right? One is sort of pool and diversified to multiple underwriting, multiple loans, but also is each transaction also sort of divided into different pieces of the loan?
So you are taking exposure with one corporate counterparty, right? Okay. Now, there are diversification nuances there also. So for example, if you're giving to an NBFC, that NBFC might have a diversified underlying pool. Oh, when you do in an invoice, it's not one counterparty invoice that you're discounting. You might also participate in 10, right? So the way we structure it is you take exposure with one particular counterparty. There'll be a diversified pool, may not be there with the underlying. That will have a reflection on the overall risk score in that sense of the particular opportunity, right? But now it's one-to-one mapping from a counterparty perspective. What we are working on is actually creating these mini mutual funds and mini portfolios so that you can actually invest in a diversified counterparty pool itself, right? Mm-hmm. Which is what we are working on here, and we are moving towards in that direction.
You know, you mentioned that most of these instruments are either unsecured or quasi-secured or... how does recourse work here? Or have you seen that yet, in the sense that when defaults happen, if they do, and when they do effectively? Because I mean, I used to find it quite, I think it was Grip Only, like, which earlier used to have this SPV structure where, you know, they would put furniture on that SPV and then lease it out and raise financing against it. And then the guys would always say that, you know, we have these assets in this SPV. So if tomorrow we liquidate them, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, it's furniture. I mean, what are you going to do? What are you going to recover out of that? You know, those questions often used to come. I think now they have also formalized a lot of these structural issues in terms of the instrument itself. But how do you, I mean, through your vintage, have you already seen some kind of, you know, days past due kind of patterns, or any kind of, you know, investor-led recourse which has happened? Because in your case, because you're also originating, effectively it's your brand also which gets tied to it, right? One way or the other. So they're also piggybacking on that. Okay, a giraffe must have done a good job. Only then I'm going to, you know, piggyback on that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, very good question, Nikhil. You know, because one of the things which I would say keeps us awake at night, right? So, if
you are one of the very few people who says that something keeps us up at night, because every second person we say, no, you are perfectly fine. I'm like, that doesn't make any sense.
No, I think the only problem we solve for in our business is managing risk, right? And I also say we are in the business of selling risk, right? So, when we actually, you know, investors are participating on our platform, it is also our fiduciary responsibility to price risk correctly, right? See, you don't know whether this risk should be priced at 18% or 12%, right? Now, I as the person originating, or let's say we as a subject matter expert, as we claim to be, then it is our duty to price that correctly, right? So I think we are in the business of selling risk on the consumer side and managing risk internally and for our customers, right? So I think that's the, I would say, the only critical thing that we do in our business. What we see till date, fortunately, you know, we've not had a single day delay. Today, we've repaid more than 1,000 crores to our investors on the platform. Today, we are in a state where we actually process 2 to 3 repayments a day, you know, so almost 80, 90, 100 repayments a month, right? But we have not, you know, seen that delay. I think first and foremost, the way at least we think about it as an organization is, first step to avoiding default is to do it at the origination step itself, right? So if you, you know, and that is where we spend most of our time, as I said, on the credit process of ours. And the second is just the DNA thought process. I'm like personally very inspired by, let's say, Kotak as a brand, right? And what I've realized, you know, if you see Kotak, they get the most rich valuations on their AUM, but their AUM has not grown for the last 4-5 years compared to, I would say, at least any other large bank, right? I think the one DNA, you would rather not do a deal than do a bad deal.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's the DNA that we also live by. That, you know, for us, you know, whatever we, you know, whatever commitments we have to our investors, whatever growth targets that we have internally, that aside, if there's something that we are not happy with, you know, in the credit, we will rather not do that transaction, right? So I think that's the first DNA as an organization that we have, right? The second question is more difficult to answer, which is how do you have recourse? I think in India, it's a country, it's very difficult to enforce legal rights, obligations, securities. In the US, it is that much more simpler. While we take everything, you know, all right, all securities, but actually when it goes into enforcement, you know, things become challenging. But I think there are 2-3 things that you do. One is to, again, ensure that your legal documents are watertight, right? I think that's the first step to it. The second is, you know, you need to, and hence, you know, you are always seeing, you know, you also need to understand for the counterparties, their first priority is banks. Second will be NBFCs, and third will be funds like ourselves or platform, right? While we are still in our growing journey, right? So how do you ensure that you are right up there in their mind when it comes to a stress situation, right? They need to deal with you appropriately with any other financial institution. So you need to have enough things built into structures, into documents, so that they give you that kind of importance, right? So that becomes very important. Finally, see, you need to also take note of things which are practical in terms of enforcement. Mm-hmm. For example, I'll tell you, you might say that I have an asset, that same question that you said, right? Let's say, you know, you might have furniture, you know, let's say as security. One part of it is the what value will you get in the secondary market? Mm-hmm. That's still aside. Let's say you'll get 20% value. The first step to knowing is, can you actually possess that furniture in case of default? Yeah. That furniture is given to maybe 50,000 customers in their individual homes. That might be lying in some corporate office. Are you going to go first, enter that corporate office or barge into that corporate office, go to 50,000 people and recover that furniture, get it in your possession? That is step one to actually realizing value. Right? So I think what we spend a lot of time on is also the practicality of the securities that we take. Right? And when
could you like maybe give an example or two in terms of, like you mentioned, the practicality of the security, which gives you some sort of actionability, and the legal structure that you follow in a typical deal?
So, for example, you know, when we, let's say, when we talk about security package and collateral, right? You can tell me that, hey, I have this 5-acre land in Mysore, you know, this is valued at 10 crores, why don't you take it, right?
Sure.
That is of no value to me. Right. You know, first, what is the he'll give me a valuation report from a valuer saying this land is worth 5 crores, whatever, 10 crores in Mysore. That has no practical value because I don't want, you know, I don't understand Mysore. Whether you can sell a 5-acre land in Mysore, how many buyers will be there to take a 5-acre land in Mysore is of not of value to me. Like, I can't attribute any comfort to this kind of security while on paper it exists, right? But on the other hand, for example, if you tell me that here is a residential apartment in Bangalore in this tower, which is worth 5 crores, and I'm pledging that to you in your name, right? Now, that is a far more, it's the same type of security, right? Land and maybe an apartment. But that is something I will enter.
But it's probably more of an operating asset, right? So that makes it.
Exactly, yeah. Right? So when I know that a 2-3 crore ticket size house in this location in Bangalore or in Mumbai in a tier one city, I can, if I have it as my collateral, I can actually go register it in my name. I can create a mortgage which will actually show up in a sub-registrar office so that no one can actually sell it tomorrow. Hmm. And that is of real value to me, and I can actually enforce, liquidate it, sell it to someone if required. Right, so this is a simple, you know, I would say difference in the same asset type where you will say real estate or, you know, whatever. But, you know, one is a very illiquid security vis-a-vis one which is a liquid one, right? Similar, I would say you can also do, even in the first, in the, let me use furniture as an example again. Right, if you give me furniture as a security, I will never accept it. Why? Because furnitures, before again repossessing, first is the ownership identifiable.
Yeah.
You have, let's say that you can even repossess the asset. But there's a chair lying in a corporate office. Which is the chair that you have funded? Is there your name written on it? How do you know that, you know, this is the furniture that actually belongs to you? Vis-a-vis, when we had, you know, when we do leasing, we use like automobiles as a asset class in our leasing portfolio. Why? Because cars have a identified secondary value. You know that a car which has run 50,000 kilometers for 5 years, this make is of this value, 1 lakh kilometer. You know, so it's very, in that sense, there's some science to it. The second part is every car has an RC registration number and an RC card. Then RC card will have our name on it, right? And then you can create a hypothecation of that asset in your name as well. So again, while possession risk continues in this, but that is a security that I'm far more willing to take than furniture where, you know, I don't even know, you know, first the condition of that asset will determine a lot of things. Where, which asset is mine is a question mark for me. Right. So these are, I would say, these are practical calls to take when you are accepting security. Mm-hmm. On paper, it might be anything, but actually practically, how do you value this asset is very critical. That is what we focus on.
Right.
So it's, I mean,
rather just do unsecured lending and price it up, I guess. One step, right?
That is better rather than, you know, taking those kind of
built it into the price. Yeah, just because you talked about regulation, like, you know, debt mutual funds were sort of, for retailers at least, that was probably the easiest way to get exposure to some kind of fixed income product, right?
Mm.
And I think, was it this year, I think the LTCG benefits also sort of went away, right? Does that have an impact? Are you, does that have an impact, positive impact on sort of investors seeing you as a much more tax efficient way to sort of invest in fixed income products?
Yeah, we are not more tax efficient. Like the other products became less tax efficient than what it was, right? So, but yeah, I think, see, it will play out over a period of time, right? I think obviously debt mutual funds has seen a lot of inflows over the last few years. Now, I think investing directly in debt markets in bond will become, I would say, more attractive because of the tax parity, right? We will see how this plays out. You know, it obviously it makes, I would say, logical sense or intuitive sense that we should see a lot of that benefit coming to, I would say, products in the fixed income category. And then obviously, we'll, as a platform, we should benefit from that. It's still early days because, you know, most of the allocation for the last financial year, people have done it in a GC in the last 15 days of March. You know, so they've kind of, I would say, invested before time, maybe for the next 3-4 months liquidity that they would have had. So I think a lot of these benefits should start showing up in the, I would say, in the near term, 1 to 2 year horizon. I would believe so that, you know, this should give a good, I would say, you know, impetus to the rest of the debt markets. But, but let's see how that plays out.
And on the borrowers, right, since working capital is one big piece and, you know, invoice discounting, RBF, whatever it is, one good thing is like those problems don't get solved by just one round of borrowing. They keep coming back, right? And I guess that's where some of your scale benefits are. Like all the due diligence that you've done and sort of built the models, they need not be done for every issuer. And I mean, they need not be done again for the same issuer, right? So how many of those, like, what, I mean, roughly, like, I guess there's a trust, intuition tells me that there's a lot of repeat borrowers who sort of are just doing it over and over again, right? I mean, is that a trend?
Especially in working capital, you know, when if you are a frequent user of the platform or anyone who's a frequent user of the platform optically gets that sense. But the way actually it works is we sanction a limit to a borrower for a period of time, especially in working capital. Let's say we sanction a 25 crore limit and say that this limit is 1 year valid, right? That means for the next 12 months, I'm happy to take a 25 crore exposure with you. Now, because this is typically a 30, 60, 90 day requirement, they will repay when they collect the funds from their business and they repay us. So even if I have a 25 crore exposure and that company repays tomorrow, that exposure will, let's say, come down to 20 crores. Now there is again a 5 crore limit that the company has and they can borrow again, right? So in that sense, yes, that repeat is there. But we have given them a 1 year validity because in this 1 year, what we do is we do basic credit monitoring, and basic is also quite stringent. But when I say basic in the sense, I will go through their MISs, I will check for a few key trigger points that I want to monitor in their business. Like, is their revenue still growing? Debt is not, getting loaded, etc. So there are a few things that have become critical, but I don't do a very detailed assessment. After the end of 1 year, I will redo a very detailed assessment, almost like a fresh proposal, and then see whether I want to sanction them that limit for 1 year again or not. So in this interim, but yes, the transactions are frequent because of the short tenor of it. But this is only again for working capital. If you go to the other products that we have, which are more longer tenor, there because you are giving them a one-time dispersal and the sanctions are longer, so you will not see that repeat, that often, right? So that's
How's the repayment typically structured for the other product? Is it sort of something back on day zero as a platform fee or such, and then it's sort of segregated over a period of, let's say, a one-year product? Is that how it sort of works, principal plus interest payback, or are there some interest holidays or moratoriums? Like, is it deal by deal? How do you sort of think about that?
Yeah, so, typically every deal is structured and is customized, So typically what we like to do is, again, we have two, things to look at over here. One is that, what are the risks that the company has as an underlying business? So let's say that we find, this company, we are not very comfortable taking a 12-18 month view, but the company really wants 12-18 month money, right? Mm-hmm. So then how to balance it? We say that while we'll give you 12-18 month money, but it'll be monthly amortizing. That means you'll give me a repayment every month. So the exposure to that company keeps reducing. And after month 10, month 11, you'll see that only 10, 15, 20% of your overall exposure is actually still to be repaid. So for that exposure, I'm okay to go till month 12, with the company, right? So this is a part of risk, also the structuring part. The second is the company's underlying cash flows become important. See, let's say it's very easy to understand in an NBFC situation. A NBFC which is giving gold loans, typical gold loan tenures are 12 months, 24 months. Actually, it can go from 6 months to, let's say, 12 months, 24 months. If you're doing these unsecured personal loans, which is the flavor of the season, typical tenures are 3 months to 6 months, right? Very, very short tenure. The third is if you're doing the automobile loans, like, two-wheeler financing, three-wheeler financing, typical loans are 2 years to 3 years, right? Now, when I'm giving to a respective NBFC, I need to see how his underlying cash flows are and whether he will be able to repay, without causing any stress to the company itself. So if I'm doing an unsecured loan NBFC, I'm very happy to do a 12-month financing. But if I'm going to give money to a two-wheeler, three-wheeler NBFC, I rather give them 2 year, 3 year money because then the ALM is kind of aligned, right? Yeah. So a lot of these factors come in to decide what the tenure should be. So, and the company's financial health, strength, am I comfortable taking that kind of a tenure view with the company? So it's a multiple of these things, but so hence everything is customized and there is no one rule fits for all for us in that sense.
One thing that you mentioned obviously was that on the investor end, your minimum check size is like 1 lakh, which obviously gives access to a fair bunch of people, right? But on the other end, there is a narrative around, why fractionalization on fixed income through technology, kind of make it as small as like a rupee or 500 rupees or whatever, right? I mean, there's a lot of kind of conversation around that. And I was just wondering, effectively by being an originator, there is obviously there's only a finite amount of transactions that one can, because there's a fair amount of heavy lifting that's required on the DD end and on the issuance end, right? So is there a view that maybe in the future, you know, deals which are probably originated by third parties, you do your second level DD and then you provide a fractionalized exposure through, I don't know, blockchain or through some sort of a tech layer to your investors. Is that also something that you want to look at some stage, or it's going to be always like, you know, like a primary issuance where you have end-to-end control?
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, that's these, I would say, you know, these are things that we keep as a startup, you know, we live for experimenting, right? And mm-hmm. seeing what can we do differently and, you know, what might be a better structure, etc. Right? So I think we've kind of thought about this, right? So two things over here for us. I think, you know, at least for the near, again, the medium future, we don't see that our ability to originate will be challenging, right? Right. So I think for the first few years of our journey, we are, you know, today just north of two years old. But as we, I would say for the at least next 3, 4, 5 years, you know, for us, it's a more demand side challenge to solve for, because we are in that phase where we are still developing trust and credibility with our customers. So while that is, I would say, not yet there, or not, you know, it's not like, you know, we are the go-to platform for fixed income in the country. We are not there yet, right? So till we are in that journey, you know, for us, demand, which is side of a business, which is, you know, finding investors to invest on a platform, that is the, you know, trickier thing to solve for rather than the origination side, right? Right. So while that is not the problem, long-term, yes, origination will become a problem. If we get to a $4-5 billion AUM, can we originate high-quality credit at that volume to serve all the people that we have, you know, we have our customer? So maybe long-term, then we go down to that path where we are just, as you said, you know, there is some primary originator, you know, we do a second level of DD and then, you know, we take it onto a platform, right? So that's a more long-term view. We don't see that as a thing to solve for the next few years. Then the second part of this question is also fractionalizing, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can fractionalize it to no extent, right? You can, you know, like we do 1 lakh, you can do 10,000, 1,000, 100, 10 rupees, right? Mm-hmm. There is no end to fractionalizing. I think at some stage, right, what we want to ensure is that the people are investing in a product with the right intent. And what I mean is, you know, once it becomes 500 rupees and 1,000 rupees, you will not even bother reading two lines. You will just say that, yeah, Giraffe ne bola hai, kisi ne bola hai, you know, minus, you know, 500,000 rupees, I'm good to invest. Right? Already there is a problem that we have to solve as a fixed income platform, that in India, people think fixed income is guaranteed income, right? So there's a difference between, you know, certainty to guaranteed, right? So, or predictability to guaranteed, right? So that is already a problem. So we really want customers when they come onto our platform
to be committed,
some time in reading, understanding the product, what are the risks, and then making a conscious choice. So the higher the investment amount is, the more the customer is likely to spend time in all of these activities. The small and the lesser the investment amount is, you know, people will just be investing in 2 seconds, right? And that's where the balance for us is to draw. So that's, as I said, we spend a lot of time upfront in awareness and education, and then reduce the investment side rather than doing the reverse, you know. So that's,
but I thought like mutual funds are guaranteed, no? That's what I keep on hearing, no? That mutual funds are guaranteed, no?
Yeah.
At least that's how the bank RMs talk.
Yeah.
And right. In fixed income retail investors, right, they often, it's a common mistake. They see the word predictable and they almost always associate it with guaranteed. Predictable, yes. I'm predicting I'll get back, so it's guaranteed. But
yes,
it's between regarding cash flows. Anyway, on fundraise, right? Listen, I mean, at the end of the day, you're underwriting. Sure, you've sort of got guys that you're helping in terms of allowing them an investing angle. What does the future look like in terms of building the book further and distributing more loans, right? I mean, obviously, there's a group of people who are sort of giving you money and they're using it as a platform to make fixed income investment decisions. But is there an appetite to sort of raise wholesale debt and sort of start doing it at that level as well and sort of, you know, become almost like a debt investor of sort? Is that something you think about? Or because I know you've raised equity money, right? And you said asset liability mismatch. I mean, at some point, underwriters have to stop underwriting from equity and move to wholesale debt. And we're seeing that in startup underwriters as well, right? You're obviously different, but how do you see about that of going the book?
Yeah, so I think, the the way we think about it is, right, I think the beauty of our own business model lies in its unit economics, which I have told a lot of VC investors, obviously not everyone buys it, right? But, you know, and the reason is because for us to grow, we are not actually dependent on capital raising, right? Because we are effectively, we are a curated marketplace, right? So we don't invest our own money. So effectively, we can grow our book, our AUM, you know, without having our own capital. With wholesale debt, there are two things that come in, right? Once you do that, you need to keep raising capital to grow. The other is your cost of leverage or debt is a deterrent to the kind of opportunities that you do. For example, you know, if you are borrowing debt money and then reinvesting, what a typical NBFC does, and let's say an NBFC is borrowing at 12% or 13%, then that NBFC's cost of borrowing is then determining what transactions that NBFC can participate. Because that means they can only participate in 15, 16 plus seeds. They can't do lower, right? But if you see our platform, we have a 6, 7% offering, we have an 8, 10% offering, and we have a 17, 18% offering. The reason it's so diverse is because we don't have an inherent cost of capital, right? So I think those two things. We like the, I would say, the platform play. I think it gives us more diversity. It gives our users more diversity. Second is that once you start investing from your own book and in wholesale lending, then it's become very capital heavy. And that's not what something like. We think that the beauty of this business is in it being a platform.
Right. Right. No, but like, you know, if one has to be like a kind of devil's advocate, the angle is also that platforms never have a long-term skin in the game. Right. And cost actually brings inherent discipline also to how you lend. How do you counter that?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think it's easier said than done, right? As I mentioned that once we have some balance sheet capital, one thing we definitely want to do is that we want to at least have our own skin in the game, right? Now, whether that means that at least 2%, 5%, maybe 10%, depending on our own capital, we will invest in every opportunity and hold to maturity in every opportunity, right? Finally, if we tell our customers that, you know, we believe in the credit of these companies and hence they are on the platform, we also need to have our money where our mouth is, right? So the idea is to have some skin in the game. And, you know, the skin in the game, for example, as I mentioned, that can be very, it's not big, doesn't make us capital heavy. Like if I at least even put 5% of the book, that means for any X AUM, I need to have 5% of my own capital, right? So that is far more manageable. So the idea is, this is for two reasons. I don't think it's more for our own discipline. It is only for enabling more customer confidence, right? Right. So today, you know, customers, we can at least tell our customers that, you know, we've done the hard work. We are also putting in our own money. Mm. And, you know, that will add to consumer confidence. From a credit perspective and discipline, I think that's just the DNA and culture that we need to build as an organization. And, you know, that comes from top down. You know, that's what we focus on in the last 2 years. I hope that continues for the long run. That will determine our long-term success. So I think that is more DNA culture. I don't think having your own money, there are enough NBFCs and banks with, you know, their own money or customer capital that have gone bust, and then there are enough that have been successful, right? So I think investing your own money does not change that. I think it's more, you know, DNA and culture.
Because it's also not their money. It's someone else's money all the time, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So stay away from anything that increases the cost of capital, essentially, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, last question, effectively, like you were quite disdainful about personal loans being the flavor of the year. So obviously that you're not a fan there. But I mean, when it comes to SME underwriting, it's by default, there is a manual element there, right? I mean, it's unavoidable. And you need feet on the street. You need guys to look at books. You need to take those subjective calls to underwrite. Not the classic VC story. But you have managed to raise a fair bit of VC capital as well, right? I think you have raised around 10 mil to date. Last round was around 7.5 mil. You have Axel on your cap table. So a marquee fund. How difficult or easy was it to kind of pitch this as an angle? Or was there some level of investor education that was required? Probably if you pitch something like this today, it would resonate way more than probably, you know, a year back. Because now the ecosystem is also moved. Yes. But how was it for you?
Yeah, no, it was challenging, right? I think fundraisers are in general difficult because, you know, the conviction that you have, the kind of, I would say, time you have spent in your own business, external VC never spends that much amount of time, right? They'll have one call, few calls, many calls, let's say. but that's limited, right? So it's very hard to, I would say, communicate everything that you believe in to someone else. And hence fundraising is always difficult. I think in our case, right, like key question which we always get asked is exactly this thing that if you have to get to 20,000 crores or, you know, let's say $3-5 billion, like, you know, can you find so many companies and...
Sharad is about to draw a hockey stick, yeah. I think, hypothetically.
Yeah, right?
Absolutely. What about this?
BC's favorite...
favorite word, the hockey stick. The J-term. Yeah. So they're like, can you, like, are there so many companies in India looking for capital and, you know, why will, you know, they favor you over a bank or a traditional institution and et cetera, right? So I think, as you mentioned, so that's, you know, that's always been the hard question to answer. I think just, you know, what in VC language, what they understand is statistics, right? So like India as a country has one of the least corporate debt to GDPs, right? With, you know, a lot of the other matured economies. So he felt that there are the need for alternate capital providers in India. And, you know, and hence that's also a fundamental problem that he is solving. So the idea there are enough and more companies and, you know, there is a lot of play for any kind of alternate capital provider, whether that's a fund, it's a platform like ours, new age NBFCs, you know, there are multiple ways. But yeah, I think, you know, people who understand the credit business well get it. You know, otherwise it's a leap of faith. Otherwise, quite difficult.
With all this hockey stick chasing, I mean, you know, VCs are, VC ecosystem is quite sharp and quite strong, but in pursuit of the J-curve, there's so many businesses with no EBITDA, no paths to even EBITDA profitability, right? So, and that's why I think the old school core business of actually underwriting and actually doing the work of finding out who the borrower is and doing the channel checks like you do, screams of cash flow generation and profitability.
Right? I remember this VC telling me after, he's like, what do you do on the supply side? After I told him, he's like, you are effectively doing what we do, right? Just that we invest equity in startups and you're investing or you're, you know, you're giving debt. I was like, I would say, you know, you can broadly correlate, but I think we would be doing a better job.
Yeah. Unse puchna chahiye, unse we should ask, aapka reports kya hai? No, but it was great chatting and learning about your business. Like, obviously, it's very interesting, and we get a lot of fintech companies. We've looked at a lot of guys who underwrite and sort of issue small ticket size loans, but this is obviously sort of a very different platform and matchmaking kind of an angle, which is solving a real new asset class for retail investors, right? So it was fascinating to hear you speak about it. And unsurprisingly, it requires a lot of, it's more art than science, and there is a lot of actual wearing the banking hat and doing the work. So that's what makes it quite interesting for us.
So, thank you for having me, Nikhil and Sharad. Great chatting, and look forward to hearing to your podcast.
No, absolutely. No, thanks. Thanks a lot, Saurav. We'll be obviously tracking your business and wish you all the best for bigger and better milestones. And with that, this is Nikhil Arora, and with me is Sharad Tupran signing off.